This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Lieutenant Colonel James Wheeler, Jr. Today is August 12, 2003. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Colonel Wheeler, where are you? You are in...
I'm sitting at my desk at the Denton County Veterans Service Office, where I sit every day as a part of my duties as the assistant. Denton
okay.
County Veterans Service Officer.
So you are in Denton, Texas.
Denton, Texas,
okay,
right.
Okay, great. And it's about 8:34 a.m. Central Standard Time.
Correct.
So let's pick up with where we left off. We had discussed really basically your first 3 months in country, March to June 67, and you had recently taken over a recon unit. And why don't we pick up from there? When you took over this unit, how much did... What changed as far as your command in the field?
All right. Well, the comparison from rifle platoon leader to recon platoon leader is very dramatic because at the rifle company level, as one of four rifle platoon leaders, I certainly commanded a platoon, but at the same time I had a captain company commander that basically, if you will, was my boss in the chain of command and directed me on a daily basis as what I was to do.
Yes, sir.
By acquiring the position of reconnaissance platoon leader, I became an asset to the battalion at large and essentially answered directly to the battalion commander under that circumstance. And so my role became much, much broader, and at the same time I became an entity unto myself because I was the commander of that particular unit.
Mm-hmm.
Versus a captain down at the company level.
Mm-hmm.
So that changed, and again, as an asset to the battalion, I was expected to be and was certainly quite flexible in my duties because on any given day, I could be, you know, in support of Alpha Company, Bravo Company, Charlie Company, depending upon the circumstances of any given day.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we were something of a reinforcement unit as well.
Mm-hmm.
But primarily, even though I was in support of them, the greater part of what I did was on my own, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I had my own area of operations to work. I had my own mini fire base at time to provide security for, like at the LZ Oasis, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I was something of an entity unto myself in that regard.
What were your daily activities like?
Our day was primarily and understandably driven by intelligence. We spent a lot of time down in the Iodrang Valley where the bad guys were plentiful.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I was fortunate not to acquire a battle on the levels of what we've seen recently in the wonderful movie We Were Soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
We could just about I don't want to overstate this, but there was an area in the Iodrang when I got new troops that needed to be a little taste of combat, if you will. I seemed to always could go there in a general area and managed to find the bad guys and have a little modest firefight, if you can say that,
mm-hmm.
just for my new guys to get a little taste in a general sense.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as a battalion asset, I was I reacted a lot to, I think they called it triangulation, if the bad guys or the enemy, if you will, if someone higher level than I intercepted a radio transmission, as an example, and the communications level guys were able to do a triangulation, I guess it was called,
mm-hmm.
and kind of pinpoint where that particular push of that radio came from.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, or a lot of the time, then that was passed on down through the system from division to brigade to battalion. If it was in our general battalion area of operations, then mm-hmm. it ultimately got passed to me, essentially an 8-digit coordinate,
mm-hmm.
and off we raced to try to see if we could find the enemy in that approximate location.
Were you in platoon size or company size?
This is at recon platoon level.
Okay.
And the recon platoon was really made up of two different sections. We were a platoon, but now we're just the terminology of the structure of the recon platoon were sections, and I guess I had two sections, and so I oftentimes would, based upon the mission, allow my platoon sergeant to take, if you will, a section of my men and go and do something, run a mission mm-hmm. elsewhere from myself.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of racing to these coordinates with very little success, quite frankly.
Why not? Why did you not have the success that you thought you might?
Well, I think, down at the platoon level, I don't know what the time lapse was, from mm-hmm. when that signal was first noted, okay? I have no idea of knowing if it was within an hour or half a day, but I just know that I always responded, and I can't think of a time that when I went to the general area of the coordinates for that particular radio transmission, I can't ever remember
mm-hmm.
ever finding an enemy or having any contact in that particular context. No.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No. So we did a lot of that, and it needed to be done. It just that we didn't have the contact that one would have expected.
Mm-hmm. How much did you run across booby traps and other things set for you in the jungle there?
I've said many times throughout my life, Doctor, that I was very grateful, and this sounds a bit selfish, but it's just a true, honest statement.
Mm-hmm.
We, the 4th Division, first of all, we had the largest area of operations
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam. And we were fortunate in the sense that we were able to operate in what we call, for all intents and purposes, free fire zones.
Mm-hmm.
And we operated not around populated areas. I mean, we might, on occasion, I can stop and think, but I may have driven through the city of Pleiku, perhaps twice or three times in a year, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
As we, went from the south, say, north to Kontum or Dak Tho, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, our troops rarely, if ever, were where we weren't around any populated areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a populated area. It was more conducive to how the Viet Cong operated.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they were the known classics for employment of booby traps, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So having said that, we were fortunate that we didn't work in that kind of environment. Therefore, we did not experience an overly large amount of the booby trap scenario.
Okay.
In my daily activities.
Mm-hmm.
And that was truly a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What other kind of activities did you run with this unit?
We, everything obviously is based on intelligence. Again, being a recon, a platoon, we were airlifted at times into special operations. I can remember operating out of north of Pleiku in the area of Kontum,
mm-hmm.
and just my platoon itself, the recon platoon, our force of us, not necessarily the full amount of us, were lifted west into the Chuprong Mountains, I believe they were called,
mm-hmm.
again, based upon enemy activity. And we had modest contact, but this was way in the mountains and very difficult to traverse.
Mm-hmm.
How
long would you be out when you were airlifted and dropped?
Well, let me say, first of all, we were always out.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
On these special operations, they might, they might be a week. I can remember one of the operations because I have some photos of it. In the mountains on a Sunday morning, we were above the clouds and the battalion Chaplain Tom Deal
mm-hmm.
was flown in for a church service.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we were literally on the side of a mountain, and I took some pictures during the service, and the clouds are down below us. We were so high in these mountains. And so it was a sanctuary for the enemy, but they knew that ground well, and we didn't have any major contacts up in there because they kind of controlled it. And knew the ins and outs of it all. It was tough movement for us.
So this was classic search and destroy.
Purely.
Okay.
Purely search and destroy.
What do you think about that policy or that strategy of going out searching to try to find the enemy, destroy the enemy, and then coming back to a base camp, per se, versus maybe employing other tactics?
Well, at the time, it seemed, and I think it was appropriate to a certain degree,
mm-hmm.
no question. And certainly at that time, I didn't see past that for all. I mean, I understand tactics, and I'd studied tactics, and in later years studied even more, of course. But at the time, it seemed, and I believe it was, for all intents and purposes, based upon the fact that we were dealing in an unconventional war scenario,
mm-hmm.
that for all intents and purposes, it was the practical tactic to employ.
Okay.
I don't have any real problems with that.
Okay.
And due to our versatility, we were able to bounce about the battlefield, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
Pretty efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How long did you run the recon unit?
I ran the recon unit until essentially the end of calendar year, roughly the end of calendar year 67.
Okay. And let me ask you about the intelligence. You said a lot of it was driven by the intelligence. How would you rate the intelligence that you did receive?
Well, I'll tell you, if I had to rate it, well, that's not quite right. Certainly, however they triangulated these communication signals had to be real.
Mm-hmm.
They had the technology to do that, and there's no doubt that a radio signal was transmitted. However, by the time if I had to grade it out, it would seem to me the efficiency of passing that information down through channels was slow.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just Jim Wheeler, because I don't know
mm-hmm.
exactly or precisely, but I just know, as I've said earlier, literally every time, and I responded to many, many, many of those,
mm-hmm.
I never, ever made contact with the enemy in that particular scenario.
Okay. Are there any incidents that come to mind when you think about this time period when you're running the recon unit?
Well, I can put a number of things. For whatever the reasons, my recon platoon became a very popular unit within the confines of the battalion.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, there's a little bit of romanticism with it because, again, we were kind of an extension, or we were not a pure part in the configuration, in a sense that a company is very much by the book, and a commander has so many people to work with. It's very structured, is the word I was seeking there. Very
mm-hmm.
structured,
mm-hmm.
and pretty much conventional in its way of operation.
Mm-hmm.
However, the recon platoon, just by the name, and then we got to do a slash and add scout to that.
Right.
When we went mechanized, so there was a certain amount of romance, in a sense, associated with the recon platoon, and we had a very good success in our endeavors at large in the field. And for some reason, my platoon became a very, very popular a place to seek,
mm-hmm.
and I truly had, so to speak, cooks, typists, and bottle washers trying to gain entry into the recon platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all driven, you know, again, by just the basic reputation of the recon platoon,
mm-hmm.
and what we did and the way we operated. And I did operate a little bit unorthodoxly, in a sense. In other words, the steel pot. I'll give a secret here.
Okay.
The steel pot, as you know, is not the most favorite item a soldier has to carry or wear.
Yes, sir.
Now, it becomes wonderfully nice and immediately on the head. As soon as the first round starts coming in, no matter where the pots have been stowed or put, they make the heads very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But just out and about, humping the bush, as we did day in, day out, and many days, as is well known, I mean, we could go many days, of course, many days, and without having any contact. So, and that's where the importance of leadership starts taking place, because
mm-hmm.
you have a responsibility to those men, and even though it's human nature to get lax and slough off, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
you can't allow that to happen. And I work very diligently at not doing it, mm-hmm. not allowing that to happen. I'm heart and soul, but anyway, so, you know, days of humping with this heavy helmet on your head, and I suffer to this very day, you know, with neck problems from that thing.
Really?
Yeah, that just that poundage on your head, you know, takes its toll on the neck.
Hmm.
And so I visit my chiropractor regularly for that.
Hmm.
Okay. I'm sure jumping out of airplanes didn't help, but nonetheless, the point I'm getting to is what I allowed my soldiers to do, unknown to the chain of command,
mm-hmm.
is allow them to get berets.
Okay.
And we were able to get them, you know, the guys in the rear, our supply guys, could get into Pleiku, which was the city near the 4th Division base camp of Camp Inari.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to get berets mm-hmm. purchased on their own. Okay. Well, they went one step farther. They not only did they get the berets, and this is all happening in the rear, and as you know, American soldiers have great ingenuity.
Mm-hmm.
And they got produced just like the Ranger tab. I know you're familiar with the Ranger tab, but they had a recon tabs made,
mm-hmm.
Unbeknownst to me, and started and got those put on the berets. And so what I did on occasion is once we were away from any main forces and were, let's just say, introduced by helicopter into the bush for special operations or something,
mm-hmm.
even though I could have suffered grave consequences had there been a head injury in a battle with you know, wearing berets, it really lifted the spirits of my boys.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key thing to me. And so even though I'm really am a by-the-book guy, I'm a dress-right, dress-guy, I did allow that to happen, and it really, something that simple really caused an esprit de corps to take place, or that was part of the total,
mm-hmm.
totality. And that's one of the little sidebars that I thought was kind of unique to us,
mm-hmm.
And became, you know, popular unto ourselves.
Right. Okay, as a platoon leader, how did you deal with losing a man?
I certainly was greatly bothered, but there was something about our war, and I've read this, I've probably seen it in the Vietnam movies where guys say they purposely didn't try to get too close to your buddy.
Right.
Kind of a theme, and that isn't exactly my case because I did know. I didn't distance myself from any one person, and I always was there doing whatever they did. I walked point. I carried a machete, even though that wasn't my job. I was down there with them, so I was right with my guys, and got to know them pretty well. But of course, you were more close to your what you call your command post or your CP.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guys that carried your radios. The guys that were, if you had an FO or field artillery lieutenant with you for a forward observer and his radio guy, you spent a much greater amount of time around those guys, so you came to know them a lot more than, you know, a PFC rifleman in the father's platoon or section.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that aside, death is death, and it isn't a pretty thing, but at the same time, I myself, through some unknown source internal to me, dealt with it pretty well.
Okay.
It bothered me. It bothered me deeply, but I was able to shake it off and move on because we can't do anything for the dead other than honor them. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got to get on with the mission. It's like some people would get upset if you call a dust-off, a helicopter
mm-hmm.
chopper in to bring out the wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And try, and if it was a pretty good battle, in general terms I'm speaking, and the helicopter is full and you're trying to put a KIA on board, a kill in action, often, sometimes, depending upon the circumstance, the pilot would say no to that. And, of course, it would greatly upset the guys on the ground. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't his job. His job at that moment, in that time, based upon the situation, was to get the wounded out. The dead we can take care of. But it's more important to deal with the wounded right now.
Mm-hmm.
And in like manner, let's just say they weren't even on station yet, but you call and you didn't have any wounded, but you had two KIA, and it's about dark, and again, they would refuse to come out. And on the ground, your emotions are so high that you can't understand the reality of what's taking place here, but why would we bring a helicopter out near dark in a hostile environment to pick up two dead bodies, and possibly suffer the consequence of somebody else dying? So we wait till the early morning dawn and do those kinds of things.
Can you make some comments on the job the dust-off pilots did?
I love not only dust-off helicopter pilots at large. I love them to this day immensely. So many times they would come in when they shouldn't. Even, this is not a contradiction to what I've already said by any means, but I mean I've had them come in when they probably shouldn't come in. I've had them put men on the aircraft when the when the air density was there in Vietnam, especially in the dry season, was very very light anyway. So the chopper, because of the lack of humidity in the air in general terms, wasn't able to lift as great a weight as otherwise. So I've watched them strain, because we needed to get guys out, and I've watched helicopter pilots do phenomenal things with these aircraft, and always for the troops on the ground. That was what it was all about. They bring in, I know you've asked just about dust off, they did it, but I've had them bring in ammunition, you know, at O-Dark 30 kinds of things, and they were just so, so willing to support the troop on the ground.
Okay. Did you ever operate with any K-9 units?
Had a K-9 unit my second tour.
Okay.
That we can either talk about then or talk about it now, whichever.
Let's wait until we get to that chronologically.
Sure.
So tell me what happened after the first of 1968. You said you had switched. Did you switch from the recon unit, or did you continue?
Yeah, when I finished with the recon, and I had done a lot of what was all field time, and we'd had a great run up with it. But like anything in life, all good things must come to an end. And even though I didn't really want to leave, I had no choice in the matter. I think we spoke about this, Doctor, informally before, but I'm obliged to speak to this. Certainly, as we live our lives, we reflect back over and look at it, and I guess evaluate it, chew on it, and think about it. And certainly, I've done the same, especially from my wartime. And I reflect back that I think that certainly a little luck goes a long way, but I also think we make a lot of our own luck. And I think the Lord looks over us pretty strongly. And then there's just also going about your business properly, and I never personally got ambushed. Never got into a pure ambush. It's not to say that the greatest tactician in the world couldn't, because there's a little luck involved and all that stuff. But anyway, one of the things that really bothers me to this day, after I left my recon platoon, where, as I've just stated, I was never in a pure ambush, because I think that I am, I'm no great tactician, but I understand tactics and I understand how to employ them, and I don't go about it anything short of trying to do the best I can. So the fellow that took the recon platoon from me, who I did not know previously, had to be very capable, or he would not have been allowed to acquire that position, be chosen for the position, because it's a very competitive position. It's the ultimate lieutenant position of battalion. But by golly, if it wasn't the first day, it was the second. But the first full day, official day, that he had command of my old platoon, in APCs, armored personnel carriers, M113s, they were ambushed. He went right into an ambush, and his track took an RPG that killed the driver. And I was I was at the on the LZ when they brought the driver in from that, you know, when a helicopter brought him in to the medical unit there. And I still see him to this day as they brought him off the bird, but so obviously that gave me great anxiety because I, you know, it's one of those human things where, well, golly gee, if I was still in command, perhaps that wouldn't have happened, but life goes on. I moved into a wonderful position because the great infantry guy at Benning, the great ranger in the sky, always said, you know, to be a real, the perfect infantry officer is either a commander or an operations guy. Now, we still have to have S1s for personnel, S2 for intelligence, and S4 for logistics, but the S3, that's operations, and that's the heart and soul of it all. So, fortunately, I was selected to leave my platoon to go and become the assistant S3 for air.
Okay.
So, first of all, that moved me to the battalion operations level, working for a wonderful major, a great major, and I became the battalion briefing officer, was one of my principal duties.
Okay.
So that every morning and every evening, I gave the operations briefing for the battalion to the battalion commander and his staff, and of course any VIPs, if the commanding general comes in, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
I did all those briefings.
Okay. Can you describe kind of maybe a typical briefing, what it entailed?
Yes. I did this coincidentally right back at the LZ Oasis a year after I left Vietnam and came back. I was now the assistant three as a captain at the brigade level and became again the briefing officer. And in both instances, what I really and truly very much so pride myself on is, and no one said I had to do it this way, but I always went the extra mile, and I got up extra early to commit all of my briefing to memory.
Okay.
So that when I stood, and a typical briefing was, you know, early in the morning, the battalion commander would arrive with his, well, the principal staff is already there, and the commanders or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And we just simply went over what had transpired literally since, and in the morning briefings, weren't generally nearly as involved as the evening briefings because we just briefed the night before, but for a given morning briefing, I would brief following the S1 and the S2. Of course, the S2 briefed off the map pretty much too because he's the intelligence guy, and always had his notes. Well, like I say, I was up an hour or two before anybody else, and went into the Tactical Operations Center, and really worked diligently. At when I took my pointer and pointed to a site on the map, I had, you know, 16:30 hours yesterday, sir, Charlie Platoon of, you know, I made contact with X number of bad guys, enemy, and the results were pop, 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 and I just did it by the numbers, and I'm very, very proud in, of how I went about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I very much enjoyed doing that. Of course, during the course of the day, I'm working with the major, you know, and moving forces and evaluating intelligence and making plans for operations, et cetera, insertion of the troops. A great sidebar to that was because I was also the air, meaning that I controlled, if you will, the utilization of aircraft, I was allowed to go into Pleiku and attend an aerial observer, an AO course, with a fixed wing, the old L-19 aircraft, and fly in the back seat as an aerial observer for multiple reasons, from flying a horseshoe and calling in artillery to just flying out and doing reconnaissance from the air as I did before on the ground.
Right.
So I spent I was able to, a nice aside to that was when I attended the school, which was probably a week, maybe 2 weeks, but probably a week, I was awarded crewman wings coming out of the school. But what I was able to do, I was able to fly enough combat hours and missions that awarded me those wings permanently.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always worn on my uniform. They're not pilot wings. They look like, you know, I don't have the shield. Where the shield is on the pilot wings, there's like an eagle on mine, but I was able to acquire those, which was a nice aside to it all and gave a little versatility to what I did on a daily basis there in my last 3 months.
Okay.
And with the 2nd Battalion, 8th Infantry.
Which did you enjoy better, running, kind of doing the operations back behind the lines or actually being out in the bush?
Oh, I was a field troop, undeniably. I adored what I did in the field.
Okay.
Now, interspersed in there, if you allow me, mm-hmm. This is really a nice story, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
I've already mentioned Chaplain Tom Deal, who was our battalion chaplain.
Yes, sir.
Also, a fellow that I had gone to officer candidate school with had also was assigned to our battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we weren't assigned to the same unit, so I didn't see him like on a regular basis. But nonetheless, he was there,
mm-hmm.
and I knew him. Well, I had met my mate for life before I went to Vietnam, my wife now of 36 years next month. And our plan, we developed this plan over the time to actually meet for R&R in Honolulu in September of 67
mm-hmm.
and marry.
Okay.
So, very unusual circumstances. I brought with me, it worked out. I mean, we worked at working it out, but I was able to travel to Honolulu for my R&R with my battalion chaplain,
mm-hmm.
Tom Deal, and Lieutenant Morris Rousey, who was my best man.
Okay.
So we traveled to Honolulu together,
mm-hmm.
and actually I had Chaplain Deal perform our marriage ceremonies there
mm-hmm.
On September the 30th of 1967. And it sure took, because she's my sweetheart.
Right.
That's just kind of a very unique, I think, kind of a unique deal.
Absolutely.
To do that. Gosh, there's probably many more stories, but that kind of runs us through. Certainly, with the turn of the year into 67, into 68,
mm-hmm.
We experienced that wonderful thing called Ted of 68.
Yes, sir.
Certainly, I was there now. But at that time, now I was at the battalion operations level.
Mm-hmm.
But we said we were at the LZ Oasis, and we were able to get up on the talk. We didn't have any direct attacks on our little artillery fire base there
mm-hmm.
at all. But Pleiku was not too far away, a major city in the Central Highlands, and we were able to observe and be aware of all kinds of activity with fast-moving, high aircraft, et cetera, taking place in the distance. So I was there for Tet 68,
mm-hmm.
but I wasn't, mightily involved other than directing, units about.
Right. Can you tell me what happened that morning and in the subsequent days, what you actually did?
It just was our normal day, maybe, to the fourth power.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we were a lot was going on, and we had to direct and or redirect forces to areas, for example, into the city that we were never in the city as such. Okay, but the engineers that were engineers, their secondary MOS is infantry anyway, but they are engineers first, and they were in town performing as infantry,
mm-hmm.
But they needed reinforcement kinds of help. So we were involved to some degree in providing reinforcements into that kind of a situation, particularly in Pleiku.
Okay. All right. You left your first tour, you left in March 68, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And where did you go when you left country?
I went to the 1st Armored Division,
mm-hmm.
Fort Hood, Texas,
mm-hmm.
and became a company commander. Commanded Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 46th Infantry,
mm-hmm.
the 2nd Brigade of the 1st Armored Division.
Okay. How did it feel leaving Vietnam that first time? Did you think you would be going back, or did you think that was it? That was my tour and done?
I knew there was no doubt, leaving in 67, I'd already met particularly pilots that had already on their second tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew, I think, unequivocally that I would be returning.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I had chosen to do.
Okay.
And if I may, if I had met my friend for life and married
mm-hmm.
Doctor, I would not have left Vietnam after a year. I don't know what the extension circumstances were for officers, because I knew I'd be back soon enough anyway. You know, we could allow our soldiers to extend.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was 3 months or 6 months at a time. I can't remember. But if I had not been under the circumstance of being married and all, I would not have left Vietnam.
Why?
At my normal Dero state, because I was committed to what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
It was. I don't want to sound trite, but it was our big game, and I don't mean it as a game whatsoever. But I mean, this is all the training and all the study that you do
mm-hmm.
to employ those kinds of things in the real world of battle.
Mm-hmm.
And why leave? This is it. How long is it going to last? We don't know. And without question, I would have extended without question until they kicked me out. Now, that wasn't the circumstance, because, as I said, we came back and I was back 8 months and had orders to return.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you what the war did to people, though. What I've just said causes me to think about a Sergeant Nipper
mm-hmm.
who I acquired. He was in my recon platoon and had been there for a good long while before I arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Sergeant Nipper was a pure field soldier. He loved to fight and he loved the field. And I think, let's just say it was three months at a time. I really apologize, I'm not sure, but
mm-hmm.
I know that he had already been in country a year and extended a time or two, if you will,
okay.
when I came along. Well, I know that I allowed him to extend at least once. And let's just say it's 6 months. It doesn't matter, but because mm-hmm. the point's to be made.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sergeant Nipper started acting awfully weird on me. Okay.
What do you mean by weird?
He was off, a little off the beaten track. He is a guy that would, in general terms, he's a guy that would like, I'm not saying he did this, but in other words, he's a guy that would like to go off and get himself lost and hunt down Charlie by himself, so to speak.
Okay.
And do off-the-wall or unorthodox kinds of operations in the field. And so he had just kind of turned, you know, about 45 degrees from the norm.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a problem to me. He was becoming a problem to himself.
Okay.
Well, he may have been a problem to me too at some point, perhaps. But I mean, what I saw was that he had been there too long. He was too engrossed in it,
mm-hmm.
and all the above. And so I remember not exactly the moment, but I remember when he came to me, if you will, and was asking for another extension,
mm-hmm.
yet another extension. I declined. And he was not a happy camper, as we say.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't happy at all, and we had, you know, a little discourse there,
mm-hmm.
probably more than just the one time, but it was for his own gain and his own benefit and his own good that I as a commander with that responsibility, chose to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't popular for him at that time, but I'd like to think today he better understands it.
Have you heard from him or talked to him since?
No,
then?
Sir, no, not at all,
okay.
not at all. But,
okay.
I mean, there many examples, but he's one that comes to mind like that.
Mm-hmm.
You just stayed there too long, and you just gets too morbid.
Mm-hmm.
Morbid is a good word, I guess.
You weren't afraid that that would happen to you?
Well,
I know that's speculating because you were married and you went home and you had that going, but
I'd like to think I'm above it, but I'm only human also.
Mm-hmm.
And war does. I mean, I did some things there that I wouldn't care to even talk about that are really off the chart from who I am as a good honest Christian man, mm-hmm. but it does things to you. You come up with, in one sense, a totally separate set of values, you know, for human life.
Can you expand on that? What do you mean, a different set of human values?
Well, realizing that, you know, one of the commandments, thou shalt not kill, mm-hmm. and perhaps your first kill, even though the greater preponderance of us never saw who we shot, you know, in general terms, but nonetheless you're involved with killing,
mm-hmm.
either personally or from afar or in between, but after a while, in my mind, it especially dealing with the enemy, I mean, certainly the death of your own American troops bothers you greatly, and if it doesn't, something's wrong, and I don't know that you don't reach that point too, to a certain degree,
mm-hmm.
that you've seen so much death, have been around it, and you smell it and taste it and live it on a daily basis, it starts to take on its own, I guess, aroma about you, so to speak. I'd like to think I would have not, I don't know if it's descended to the level that I was seeing Sergeant Nipperette, but there again, I'm just human, and I really... really had no problems whatsoever, and I think most don't. I'm not, but I didn't have any problems with killing the enemy. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's what we were there for, and that's where it stops. I mean, I would never allow my people or myself to go past basic killing, but
mm-hmm.
there are reports of really atrocities that I. No, I could never descend to that level, the mind is a mighty thing, as you well know.
Mm-hmm. You brought up something in answering that question that I wanted to talk about. Is were your religious beliefs, your spiritual beliefs, changed at all because of your experience in Vietnam? And I know we haven't talked about your second tour yet, but just in general, can you reflect upon that?
Well, fortunately for me, I was raised in church, and... And I thank God to this day that I know He carried me through so many things, protected me in so many ways in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
in both tours, and I'm keenly aware of that. So I went there as a Christian to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But, interestingly enough, even though I had been baptized as a younger person, I just used this chaplain a lot. I have pictures of it. I had meant to bring when I was out there, but I will ultimately provide some pictures. But
mm-hmm.
I was baptized in the Dock Tho River in Vietnam hmm. by Chaplain Deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's very special. One of the guys that carried my radio that first tour is still a dear friend of mine, a gospel singer up in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
He was there. In fact, I got him a job. I got him out of the field when I left Vietnam. I got him a job as the chaplain's assistant. After this, he was still in my recon platoon at this particular point. But I've got pictures of us at the river, in the river, during the baptism. And an hour later, I was on a helicopter making a combat assault.
Hmm. Now, why did you choose to get baptized there in Vietnam?
Because I guess because it had been as a youngster when it happened to me before,
mm-hmm.
and let me go back even farther. I was raised in the church. I even sought out churches on my own.
Mm-hmm.
But I was before I went to Vietnam. I was home, of course, on leave in Memphis, Tennessee, and I was at my best friend's mother's and father's house.
Mm-hmm.
She was like a second mom to me. Country woman, and fixed a big old typical full-scale country dinner, and we were visiting in the evening,
mm-hmm.
and it must have had to be a Wednesday night service in a Baptist church, and so I was there and just visiting and having a good time, and no doubt in the way back recesses of my mind, obviously I'm heading to Vietnam in the next few days or
mm-hmm.
whatever the time element is. But you know the Lord speaks to us mightily, and I was kind of uneasy, kind of antsy there after the meal and visiting and sitting around. It wasn't like I just needed to get up and go and just leave these wonderful elderly people. But anyway, I was aware that church service was going on at this little country church out near my mother's house out in the country. And make a long story short, I was uneasy.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I knew, I just excused myself from them and said I need to go to church. And I drove out to this little old country church, Lucy Baptist Church in Millington, Tennessee, just north of Memphis, and went to that service. And when they had the preacher had the call for down front,
mm-hmm.
I was there. And so I guess what I've worked myself to, doctor, is I suppose I never got so. I went down front that night, already a Christian. I guess you could call it a reborn, modern vernacular, I guess, is a reborn Christian. I don't know that I like that term. I'm there already. But anyway, mm-hmm. call it that. And I suppose that because to complete that cycle, there was no time for baptism to go along with that because of the fact I was leaving. And so I suppose then my baptism, well, I know now that the baptism in Vietnam was a follow-up to that commitment,
mm-hmm.
and probably was about the first time it could happen. So it happened happened way into the tour. I mean, we were up at Doc Toe, obviously. I've said Doc Toe already.
Mm-hmm.
So that was well into my first tour. And I can't think now if it was before or after my marriage. But nonetheless, that transpired. It was very, very special.
How did you reconcile being a Christian in a war?
Well, I know that the Bible says that you are to follow the dictate of your government.
Mm-hmm.
I know that already. I'm a good Boy Scout, not to mention a good soldier. So I can't do something. So I'm following the dictate of my government,
mm-hmm.
and I took an oath to our government.
Mm-hmm.
I would uphold and defend, and all those things that go with that. And so I just I went into that unquestioned. Now, the way I was raised, also in my generation, if you will, mm-hmm. I was a pretty dutiful person.
Mm-hmm.
Daddy told me to do something, I did it. And likewise with any adult, for that matter. That was if within the confines of the law, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no problems in my own mind, intellectually or spiritually, doing what we had to do in war. I had absolutely no problem with it.
Have you had any problems since?
No.
Okay.
No. There's some things that happened, or things that I did there in the heat of battle, or associated with battle that I'd probably like to take back. Probably so. But do I lose sleep over it? No, because I did what was basically asked of me.
Do you want to talk about any of those incidents, or would you rather not? And obviously, you don't have to.
Yeah, I understand. Well, I'm not proud. It was kind of cutesy at the time. I'll go on record here. This isn't mutilation or something like that. And I mean, there were stories of guys, you know, that cut off ears of the enemy.
Yes, sir.
I would never allow that. Would never allow it. I can't imagine it. But one thing that, and I must say, we kind of prided ourselves on, as morbid in a sense as it sounds, is some units, some guys. I mean, everybody operated a little differently, but there were. I had my second tour West Pointer captain. He kept a deck of cards of like spades.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought about this in years, that they always laid a card on the dead enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, our calling card. What I did was I left an indelible. Unit crest on their forehead.
Okay, how did you do that?
Well, you know, the two prongs that push into the to the cloth, where we just smacked it into their forehead. And that wasn't so much as being rude, if you will, rude to the dead.
Mm-hmm.
it was more a calling card of sorts for the for his fellow soldiers to know, hey, 2nd of the 8th has been here.
Mm-hmm.
Beware. It was that sort of a thing, more so than the more, than a more morbidity kind of an issue.
Okay. Okay. Anything else?
Probably not that I should speak to.
Okay. All right. Well, back at Fort Hood, tell me what the climate was like in the United States when you came back, and what had changed, and what had changed in you?
The climate was terrible. I was much more comfortable in Vietnam than back at Fort Hood.
Mm-hmm.
For lots of reasons. Of course, one day you're in Vietnam and literally the next you're out. Of course, I had the experiences of walking into the woods with my wife back in Tennessee at my mother's, and
mm-hmm.
the weirdness of all that, not having a rifle in my hand, you know, just little weird things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that comes in time. But the troubles facing a commander in 1968 were tremendous. We'd already had riots in Detroit, Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Here I come out of war fighting an enemy, and I literally spent an inordinate amount of time as a commander, a mechanized infantry commander, doing riot control training.
Hmm.
Very, very strange. I mean, it was, but the pace of everything, especially as a young infantry guy, the pace is so fast, you don't get to spend a lot of time giving it a whole lot of thought.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a reaction. But because the pace, the hours that you put in as a commander are just horrendous, and that's part of it, comes with the territory.
Mm-hmm.
But and then put on it the pressure. We had a commanding general that was just a horse's ass. There's no other way to say it. And here most of our commanders had already been to war and going to go again in short order. And we had a commanding general there, the better part of my tour at Fort with the 1st Armored Division,
mm-hmm.
that just didn't allow life to be very pleasant, and he just put so many pressures on the whole system, and mm-hmm. it just made for not a pleasant year, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But going back down to the company level at the training, we spent a lot of time, as I said, riot control training.
Mm-hmm.
We got so far as, and my company had already been, I think, to Detroit before
mm-hmm.
I got there
mm-hmm.
in riot control training, you know. And again, the irony, so to speak, of Americans, you know, fighting Americans in a sense,
mm-hmm.
was just really off the wall. And I remember one of the times. Well, I was the battalion 3 then. No, hang on. But we so spent a lot of time doing that. This commanding general, you could have your entire battalion or your entire company, every armored carrier, every jeep, everything out there online. I understand the importance of dress right dress and all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This general, first of all, had an uncanny ability to do this. But you could have 99.99% of everything to perfection, and that SOB would walk along and find a chain dangling off the back of a trailer hitch or something
mm-hmm.
and go ballistic.
Hmm.
And, I mean, literally, I mean, I and just destroy everything. It just took the breath out of you and destroyed everything. They couldn't talk about what good had just transpired.
Mm-hmm.
And this really ought to be fixed. But he was that kind of a guy. And, of course, his ADCs, his assistant division commanders, especially a maneuver, then had to be in like manner the same way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we lived and died with our 3x5 cards in our breast pockets that I normally like to keep sewn, and our starts. But
mm-hmm.
because what happened, CG would send down somebody to the brigade or battalion headquarters on a given night and ask for FM22-5, let's say, drilling ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did, he'd take the manual home and review it and find some little arcane, little far footnote of some Bravo Sierra and appear at somebody's training the next day and throw out that question. And if you didn't have the answer, woe be you, you know. Aside from all the things, all the commitment that you've made, do I sound a little bit jaundiced towards that guy? Yeah, I do. Because it was not a pretty year, especially for the majority of us who were going right back to war anyway, you know?
Did you know you were going back?
I knew it. I knew I was going back. I didn't know when, but I knew 8 months when I got back, I had orders to return. And I didn't return for a few more months. I came out in March of 68, and I was back in July of 69.
Right.
Long enough to get my daughter born. But anyway, another tough part of command at that time, along with all the strife that was happening nationally, was there again, I have to apologize for not remembering exactly, but when a soldier came out of Vietnam and got to the West Coast, if you will, it was either 90 days or 100, it was either 3 months or 5 months, and you may know that. But in other words, let's just say it was 5 months. I just can't remember which. But if you had 4 months and 29 days, you could be released early.
Right.
But if you had 5 months, then you had to stay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think overall, with all due respect to RA soldiers, and then they were great too, I remember I was awfully impressed. A lot of my impressions from firefights, those soldiers that showed up well were U.S. soldiers, right? Draftees. Drafted for 2 years. They didn't sign up. They didn't sign up for 3 years. They were drafted, and they performed immaculately in battle for the most part. Now, there were, I found E6s hiding on me in a firefight and wish I'd shot them, but there's so many stories. But so what happened is we had these soldiers, especially those who missed the cut by a few days, so to speak, who had to come and play soldier. Well, the Army, especially with this 1st Armored Division, and they couldn't at large, they didn't make any concessions. We were still operating just like whatever the norm might be. But the point is, you had a training schedule every week, and you were required to satisfy these requirements, whatever they may be, you know, going to the field and map reading and all these things. Well, when we had a parade, you know, 95% of the guys on the right side, you'd see right shoulder patches, right? Meaning these guys have been to war. So when we take them to the field to play war, they're not happy, and you can't blame them. And that was compounded by those who, say, missed the cut, right? So we got all the turmoil going on nationally. Then we've got our soldiers who've been to war come back and missed, let's just using that as the example again, missed the cut, and so they're having to pull another 4 months or whatever it is when their buddies got to go home. They're just not happy guys. And so I remember spending not only an inordinate amount of time with the riot control training, but an awful lot of time on court martial.
Really?
Yes. We commanders, because there was just so much strife going on. And then I think it was the night before we were to deploy, we actually would go into the field. No, I was a commander then. We had, of course, the black problem, okay?
What do you mean?
We had blacks who were demonstrating. And of course, they were bringing people onto posts and demonstrating. We had been alerted to go to. This wasn't a full deployment, but we were alerted. We the unit were alerted. Let's just say to go to Chicago, Detroit, LA, wherever. And so everybody was supposed to, you know, be in formation with their uniforms and this, that, and the other. And like on a Friday night, you know, after a full week of training, and we were on alert. And I remember six black soldiers sat down in the middle of a road somewhere and refused to move. And I remember even the division commander going down there, and ordering them to move, but to see there were outside sources coming in and being a part of this. And so they ultimately arrested, of course, these guys and took them to a makeshift, I think it was a makeshift stockade because I remember going there the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the alert was called off, say, at 2 a.m., 0700 hours, I and the other commanders had to go down to the stockade because of not only the six, there were more involved as well. But anyway, we had to go down there and walk through this stockade to identify, try to identify these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking through there, and they're turning their backs on you, you know, playing this game. And this is insane, Doctor. I mean, God dang, I thought I left the enemy in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so those kinds of circumstances were going on. I had a guy I had to, I think it was a full court-martial, when a guy, I had a black guy sign out for his weapon at the armory.
Mm-hmm.
And my armorer brings me the sign-out sheet, and it shows this guy, H-Rap Brown. Instead of signing his name, he put H-Rap Brown, okay?
Well.
Yeah. Well, I had to deal with it. I mean, what is this all about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then I had one of those guys, I refused to present him a Silver Star. I told him, I'm a soldier, you tell me to jump and I'll ask you how high.
Mm-hmm.
But I had one of those H-Rep Brown guys who got a Silver Star, you know, followed him to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no doubt that he earned it. And my God, Silver Star. But I told the Italian commander, I will not present this to him. I refuse.
He
understood.
Is that the guy who signed H-Rep Brown?
No, he's another one.
Okay.
But in that same vernacular, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But we are having those kinds of problems as commanders. And, you know, and about every other week they'd come and take one of your APCs or your recon tracked vehicles from your motor pool, you know, because they were needing to, you know, get them to Vietnam because of all that. So, boy, command was tough. In the best of times, command is tough. And add all that to it, and then you've got a bride at home, and you'd like to spend some time with her. And so I was home long enough to get my my second grade school teacher daughter born. She was 6 weeks old when I had to return to Vietnam.
How was that, leaving your family?
Well, not good. I mean, we took it in stride. My wife is the ultimate military wife. She was, her father was a quartermaster officer.
Mm-hmm.
I never let him forget that he was quartermaster, a support troop in his life, but that was all in fun. So, my wife, of course, had a basic understanding of the challenges and the sacrifices that are just part of everyday life with a military family, and I just wish the world at large would better understand what we call factors X, the sacrifices that military families do take or have to give up. But anyway, I have the grandest wife in the world, took it in stride. What else can we do?
Right.
She wrote me, my wife wrote me letters every day I was gone, both tours, with the exception of one day, one time. And as I had a little footnote, I spoke at Flower Mound. I was asked last year to speak at the anniversary of 9/11 in Flower Mound, Texas. And so I shaved my little goatee thing and put on my uniform. And when I was bragging on her, I told her, and I said, and I think she wrote me twice on Sunday, once before and once after church, kind of a little footnote. But I didn't really relish leaving them, but at the same time, it was just part of what we did. And,
right.
And we knew it was coming, and you just sucked it up and did it.
In that interim period at Fort Hood, how much did people ask about your previous Vietnam experience? How much did you talk about it with military personnel and then with civilians?
Had little to no contact, literally, with civilians, Doctor. Because again, as a commander, and then I was, and I'll tell about the three job, but we were just so much time spent at the unit level, number one. There was what free time you had was, you know, spent with your wife at home, but for the most part. And then, of course, your fellow commanders were all, had all, you know, the basic experiences yourself. And so there was a commonality there, and it was such a normal part of our lives that I don't know that we sat around and dwelled on it too much.
Mm-hmm.
Because we'd all been there. What's there to talk about? Oh, I'm sure we had our discussions, you know, and
mm-hmm.
the application of tactics and this, that, and the other. But
mm-hmm.
it just was, as I've said over the years, I wasn't a guy that just went back to the block and then faced all the things that the average young soldier faced when he went home.
Mm-hmm.
Because of my environment, the arena in which I operated with fellow officers who were having the same basic experience as myself,
mm-hmm.
they weren't out of the norm.
Right.
Versus especially the younger man that did his 2 years or even three and returned home.
Mm-hmm.
Much different scenario.
Mm-hmm.
I think I lost a point there, but...
Okay. Why don't we take a break?
We can do that.
Okay, continuing now. You wanted to mention one other thing about Fort Hood before we go back to Vietnam.
Yes, one, if not two, but certainly Fort Hood. I was a first lieutenant at this time, and I'm going to make captain in September of 1969.
Mm-hmm.
Of 68. But right now I'm a first lieutenant, company commander, Charlie Company, 2nd of 46, and all of my fellow company commanders are captains.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we've kind of already talked about, the times were very difficult at this particular point in our history of the Army in particular, and we were short officers and this, that, and the other. And so not unlike my reconnaissance platoon scenario, I was the only first lieutenant company commander. The others were captains, obviously senior to me.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, I was blessed, and while still a first lieutenant over the captains, I was selected by the battalion commander to be the battalion S3,
okay.
which is a major's position,
mm-hmm.
a major's billet. So I literally became a battalion, a mechanized infantry battalion operations officer, or S3, as a first lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately was promoted, again, in September to captain. So I only had three months, actually, roughly 3 months as company commander before I moved up to be the battalion 3.
Okay.
And that was a nice thing.
Mm-hmm.
Before that happened, maybe this is why, I just think about one other nice little coup. We were invited to, I think it had to be Memorial Day weekend. It had to be Memorial Day, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
One of those kind of holidays, and I know I just have to think. But anyway, our battalion was selected by the division to march in that parade in Austin, Texas, you know, at the state capitol.
Yes, sir.
So what happened is I was selected. I was still, I guess, the company commander. And myself and the battalion sergeant major were charged with putting together a composite marching unit,
mm-hmm.
meaning I took bits and pieces from each of the companies and put together a composite marching unit, which we drilled probably for an inordinate amount of time, and we went down to Austin, Texas, and got the first place for marching in that particular parade
mm-hmm.
for Memorial Day, and I was kind of proud of that because it wasn't like it was my pure unit. As I said, it was a composite, but that was one of those little high... We needed some high points during that year at Fort Hood, and that was one of them that just came to mind as we were going through the Fort Hood process.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But as I say, in July of 69, daughter 6 weeks old, I did return to Vietnam, and that's where we want to go at this point.
Yes, sir. What was your position when you returned, or your assignment?
Ironically, when I got to, I guess it was Benoit.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I'd just been out of country just over a year, and I had been a very mobile individual in the 4th Division area of operations.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, the system wanted to send me to the 9th Infantry Division.
Okay.
And there I was, a young captain, and I said, you know, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me to go to the 9th Division. Now, I also was aware that I didn't have web feet, you know,
mm-hmm.
that the 9th spent a lot of time waiting in rice paddies, and that was probably as much as anything driving me to do what I did. But really, and more so, though, was the fact that I really knew the basic area of operations for the 4th Division pretty well
mm-hmm.
and hadn't been gone too long. And so I literally had to go through a little chain of command there. I really did, 2 or 3 levels, kind of arguing my case
mm-hmm.
tactfully, that it just really made a lot of sense to me to return to an area of operations that I was relatively familiar with, and finally got to a colonel who kind of agreed that that made sense.
Mm-hmm.
So in short order then, I was, I don't know that I was ever on orders to the 9th. I can't say that emphatically, but that's where I was, they were pointing me. But anyway, wound up back at Camp Inari, the 4th Division
mm-hmm.
headquarters, went into G1, and the brigade commander, Colonel Volney Warner, who later retired as a 4-star, was the brigade commander out at LZ Oasis, ironically enough.
Mm-hmm.
And he had gone on record with the G1 that the next captain that walks in that door that has prior experience with the 4th Division, he wanted him.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be the guy that walked in the door and fit what he was looking for. He, I mean, he had a staff of people, but he needed or wanted someone that was more familiar with the AO.
Okay.
So in short order, I was right back at the LZ Oasis
mm-hmm.
where I was in 67 and became the battalion, the brigade. Now I'm at brigade level, S3, assistant S3,
mm-hmm.
Working for Colonel Warner and his S3.
Mm-hmm.
And again became the principal briefing officer for the brigade, so now I'm at obviously a higher level than before and
mm-hmm.
briefing daily attack, daily operations. And
mm-hmm.
and in short order, had the battalion, the battalion commanders of that brigade trying to get me. But good Colonel Warner kept me there for close to 6 months and 5 months, actually, I guess it was, but as a brigade assistant 3. And at that point, I took command of Alpha Company,
mm-hmm.
1st Battalion, 14th Infantry, in December of 69,
mm-hmm.
down at Bambi Tuit.
Okay. Tell me about your daily activities as the assistant S3, and what was different between now you're briefing the brigade. What had changed?
Well, certainly the scope of it is on a larger scale. Basic operations are still the same. I found it very odd, in a sense, as a sidebar of sorts, that here we were, if you will, fighting for the same ground that
mm-hmm.
we were just doing last year, the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw that, more importantly, when I, more clearly perhaps, when I was on the ground with my company and having, if you will, guys wounded literally on the same ground for all intents and purposes that we passed through this before. That's when a certain amount of consternation started probably entering my mind and starting to do a little questioning as to what in the world are we doing here?
Mm-hmm.
Can't we do a better job? That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of a jump forward. The brigade level, of course, it was a bit more. Of course, the entire LZ had been expanded over this particular year. They even had hooch maids on. It just took me by surprise that they had the locals working on the little, I don't even want to call it a base, but on the LZ. It's pretty, you know, it was a pretty good sized place now. And literally within a day or two, and I'm going through this process of saying, I can't believe this is happening. There's a little barbershop down there, this, that, and the other.
Mm-hmm.
And literally within a day or two of me getting there and overnight becoming the briefer, we had an attack on the wire.
Mm.
And so I have his picture right here on my wall. He was at that time retired now, Lieutenant General Don Pepke, but then he was the division commander.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he was immediately there that next morning after this attack on our wire. And there I was, caught up front, briefing, and then I started, he bit me in the butt, you know. I responded to a couple of things, in a way, because I was brand new.
Mm-hmm.
The major should have been up there, the colonel should have been up there, and so I answered in a way that was right, but he didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting burned and thinking that, you know, I shouldn't even be here. My boss should be here. But that aside, ironically, the brigade commander had been in the barber's chair the afternoon before, and one of the bodies pulled out of the wire was the barber.
Wow.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Again, those were the kinds of things that had me thinking, come on, this is not what we're supposed to be doing. And so I guess early on I started questioning to a certain degree how we had arrived at where we had arrived. Because
mm-hmm.
I was very much a field soldier.
Right.
And I didn't agree with, I didn't particularly agree with what I was seeing.
Well, can you expand on that? What were you seeing that was making you feel this way?
Well, the one example, just for me personally, and I only have my little microcosm here of, mm-hmm. of my views, but why do we have the locals on base, you know? I mean, I saw that instantaneously. Why do we have that? Yeah, I know we need barber and all that, but we can do that internally into ourselves, but, you know, there are also those empire builders. You know, expansion is great.
Mm-hmm.
So that bothered me early on, and then within the first day or two, as I said, it came to fruition in my mind that wasn't necessarily such a good idea, because it was the same old thing that we've read over time and again. Who really is the enemy?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know. And so everybody has to be suspect, so why bring them on base, is my opinion.
Right.
Division may be a little different. At division, you're running a city, but one little old brigade headquarters, I didn't agree with it, and it proved itself out.
Did you make your opinion known, or did you keep that to yourself?
Oh, I certainly wasn't overly verbose about it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that I had that kind of a conversation with my immediate boss, the major.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I wasn't about to overly espouse it. That's not what I was there for.
Right. What were your daily activities like there?
Just a very full day. Again, I'm kind of overdone. I just like I did at battalion level at briefings, I really did go above and beyond what was expected, but that was my own internalization of that. And so, again, very prideful about how I presented the briefings. And now at brigade level, we had an awful lot, not an overabundance, but we had not just a morning and evening briefing, but we had VIPs, you know, come in at different times. Not every day necessarily, but there were a lot of VIP kind of briefings, whether it's the CG coming in, whatever it might be.
Let me interrupt you just for a moment. Let me change the disc out.
Sure.
Hold on just a second. Okay, why don't you continue?
Okay.
Daily activities and what is...
So, again, at least a good part of my day was made up of preparation for and conducting briefings both morning and evening.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I was the assistant S3. But at brigade level, we did have some planning officers who literally almost stayed in their little cubby holes over there doing planning. So I was more of real-time guy,
mm-hmm.
versus the planning captains that... we're planning future operations. I guess we had some input, but for the most part, I was right there in the talk throughout the day and certainly early evening. Again, a little bit of an overkill, where we had constant radio communications with the battalions,
mm-hmm.
to just be constantly up on the fact that I was called on the brief at any and all times. I just needed to be keenly aware of what was going on, literally from minute to minute, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent my days and nights were just spent right there in the talk. maintaining the pulse of what was happening in our brigade area of operations.
How difficult was that for you?
I loved it.
Okay.
It was very natural for me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a strong work ethic and a high energy level and all those, of course I was young too, but it just fit. The whole scenario, Doctor, whether it was, in the field with the recon or rifle platoon,
mm-hmm.
It just all fit nicely for me. It just fit.
Mm-hmm.
It really did.
Okay.
Colonel Warner at the time, was, a sharp and bright, officer, obviously. Mm-hmm. He retired as a 4-star. So he had, he was into teaching us. I remember, aside from the tactics, operations side of the war, we didn't have a really nice mess hall there of sorts, but in other words, he used the mess to cause us to better understand what officers are all about and how we should conduct ourselves. And
how so? Can you give an example?
I'm just trying to think as I say that. I just remember him causing us to understand that we have a certain level of importance in the hierarchy of it all, and these aren't the right words, but I just remember him having special little functions at dinner now and then,
mm-hmm.
What he was doing was above and beyond what he needed to be doing there in that kind of environment, but he brought a flavor of almost British to us, you know, something
mm-hmm.
above and beyond.
A lot of protocol.
That's a good word. That's a good word, a lot of protocol.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were able to learn from him.
Yeah, I had the good fortune of over the years never working directly. Well, I didn't have the good fortune of not working for him. I wish I had. Never working directly for him, but working escorting him when he was a 1-star, when he came to Fort Bliss, and
mm-hmm.
then when he commanded the 9th Division, he spoke at Command and General Staff College when I was a student there, and
mm-hmm.
I got to have lunch with him, and then an exercise in Alaska, so we kept popping into one another. And what was ironic is I got to the infantry branch back in, I think it was 82.
Mm-hmm.
I was there on TDY and went into the infantry branch to do something. And when I signed in, there was a Volney Warner there.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lady had escorted me over there. And I said, "My goodness, General Warner's here." And this young man said, "No, sir, his son, Captain Warner." And I got to meet this man's son who is now a captain.
Mm-hmm.
But I have his picture here on my wall. He's a very, very special person to me. But anyway, I worked for him essentially those 5 months,
mm-hmm.
Learned a lot.
What were your living quarters like?
Well, we lived in tents,
mm-hmm.
but they were tents. I don't even know how many, you know, there were probably at least four of us, I'm sure, captains to a tent.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a cot, you know, we slept on a cot. And of course, the tents were sandbagged, you know, sandbagged around.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, I've told you already, there were hooch maids, which is
mm-hmm.
the strangest thing in the world. They did wash, I guess. I guess they swept out the, you know, we had, I guess, wooden floors or something,
mm-hmm.
boxes or something. But I don't remember, even though I was probably there 5 months, I don't remember an inordinate amount, a lot about that. I don't remember much about it. I spent so much time in the operations area. I know I went there and slept and
mm-hmm.
shaved and whatever I did, but it was not anything overly dramatic for me. I was still a field soldier.
Right.
But yeah, it was comfortable versus sleeping on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But we also had rats. I can remember. You know, anytime you have that kind of environment, you got lots of rat rodents about. We had some terrible, terrible rats just come to mind as I was speaking.
Did they come into your hooch? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you eventually are going to go back out to the field, is that correct?
Absolutely.
What happened? How did that happen?
Well, In general terms, I probably got longer in the field my first tour than the norm, mm-hmm. in a sense, and I would have stayed until I deer roast if they would allow me. But, you know, a commander has a responsibility,
mm-hmm.
and he's got to share that wealth. Now, what's interesting, Doctor, is Colonel Warner called us into his quarters. When I say us, myself and two or three other captains
mm-hmm.
were called into his quarters one evening. And he was basically saying words to the effect, you know, well, children, it's time now to leave Mother Hen, so to speak. In other words, okay, boys, captains, men, you've been here for 4, 5, or 6 months, and
mm-hmm.
we've got, in words to the effect, I'm sure, you know, we got guys in the field that need to come out, and you all need to go and get that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, I would have gone straight to the fields upon arrival, for that matter,
mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, one of the planning guys, I can almost see him now, he balked. He wasn't interested in the company.
Hmm.
And he's an infantry officer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, oh, Colonel Warner, though, he's so smooth and he's so intelligent and all that. And he dealt with the guy, and I remember him explaining, you know, the reality of life and career
mm-hmm.
and all that. But I was probably as stunned as, I guess, maybe the colonel at this guy really kind of started waffling, and, you know, of course, he had been there long enough to know that you do get shot out there, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and these kinds of things happen. And he just wasn't too interested, but neither was the colonel too interested in him staying any longer.
Mm-hmm.
So we ultimately, you know, all went our various ways to our respective commands, to company command.
And you took over Alpha Company?
Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 14th Infantry. I think on the 23rd of December, 69.
Okay.
Down in Bambi Tuitt.
Okay. Tell me about becoming a company commander. What was that like versus a platoon commander?
Well, certainly the base is much broader.
Mm-hmm.
You start dealing, obviously, more directly with, well, you didn't have it before, but I mean, you're not as accessible both ways to your troops.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like my troops. I like that contact, but certainly at the company command level, you've got to use, and as you should use, the chain of command, and you've got what, between you and that rifleman, you've got a platoon leader,
mm-hmm.
normally a second lieutenant, you've got a platoon sergeant, normally an E7, but rarely over there, and you even have a squad leader if you want to get down to that,
mm-hmm.
you know, to that level through the chain of command. So I can remember going, however I was transported to take the company, and, you know, having my lieutenants come in that very, very first night,
mm-hmm.
and speaking, you know, laying out who I am and what I am and my experience, and
mm-hmm.
been here, done that, and we're going to do it again kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
As we got ready, you know, we weren't there very long, just a few days, and then we moved back up back north to the division base camp, and literally moved the division base camp from Camp Inouye to Camp Radcliffe over near Anquet.
Mm-hmm.
Camp Radcliffe is the old division base for the 1st Cavalry Division, who was in the Iodrang Valley there first.
Mm-hmm.
But we moved over to Camp Radcliffe, I think in early January of 70.
Mm-hmm.
And literally became mountain goats because it's very, very, well, it's the Central Highlands anyway, but really mountainous terrain. And we spent a lot of time, well, we used to say playing billy goat, in the Bend End Province area.
Mm-hmm. What was your specific mission? What did you do every day?
There again, Doctor, it's search and destroy.
Okay.
You know, get an order from higher headquarters, whether it's verbal or written.
Mm-hmm.
More times than not, it was verbal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're sending out choppers to be, you know, we're going to pick you up and move you from this location to that location,
mm-hmm.
and search out the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had any number of occasions to do aerial reconnaissance work. Going into areas of operation. One time, the battalion commander came out in his loach,
mm-hmm.
and I had a unit across a saddle is where he was able to come in on this little loach, and we were fixing to move into a whole different area. And so he came in, got off the aircraft, stayed with my troops on the ground while I did a VR, visual reconnaissance, of the area that I've been assigned, mainly to pick out my LZs, my dummy, you know, all the above. And so we're flying around, and I've done my map work, and I've identified where I'm going to insert and where I'm going to false insert and do all these different things, and and told the pilot that I was done. And he came back and, you know, said, Roger, Captain, but you've got 15 more minutes of allocated blade time. And I said, don't need them. He said, but he didn't argue with me. He's a warrant officer, but he said, but, you know, but he just trying to be nice. He said, but, sir, you've been allocated another 15 minutes of time here. I've completed my work. Let's go back. And so we flew back, landed there on that little saddle. The colonel got into the seat that I just had vacated. 2 minutes later, that aircraft crashed, and he died.
Oh, boy.
It wasn't, I mean, it wasn't hostile fire. It was certainly in a hostile environment. The pilot survived, and we never saw him, but, I mean, a helicopter fell out of the sky. Battalion commander died. So is that the good Lord working on my behalf? I think so. Had a cute little thing. We, you know, we formally went into Cambodia in the spring of 70. And we were called in. So we had been moved into the division base camp and had gone. It was, I remember it raining. It, we went to a briefing, we being the company commanders to battalion. Maybe it was a brigade, but let's just say it was a battalion level. All the company commanders went down in this monsoon mess, and so we were basically told that within the next few days we're going into Cambodia.
Okay.
You know, the official incursion to Cambodia, and so I'm going back to my little CP. We're just stuck in some, you know, trashy stuff there at the outskirts of the base. But anyway, I had a consternation. I said, I'm sure we were told that this is close hold, understandably. So my consternation was my guys aren't going, I mean, we're not like leaving base. It's not like we're going to town or anything. That doesn't happen. So they're not gonna, the only people they're going to see are those who they see, are their own soul, their own friends. And I mean, I'm really going through this as I go back to my headquarters as to how I'm going to brief this. And but I know that I've been essentially told close hold. So I dealt with it in my mind and decided, well, we're not going to talk to anybody but ourselves. By the time any letter, if they write a letter tonight and it gets mailed in the next few days, by the time it gets back to the States, it won't be a secret that we went into Cambodia. So I made the decision, right or wrong, and for me it was right, that I was going to share that information with my troops because I wasn't compromising the mission. I mean, we were totally like quarantined in a sense. But I made that decision in my own heart and mind that I would share that with my troops, that we are in fact going to Cambodia. I just felt that, I just felt obliged that they should know that. And I did share that, and then the next day or the next, within the next day or two, we commanders were flown out to right out near the border at a special forces camp called Plaisirang. It was a special forces camp that I spent a part of Christmas 67 at, coincidentally. And I think it was the first time I saw them cook dog out there. But it was a mountain yard kind of a place with the special forces. And this is where we operated out of, and we're going to ultimately fly, you know, fly out of there to Cambodia. But anyway, this is a cute little story, if you allow me. Is like after we got there, the next day there's a there's an what was it? O-1, that old push pull, what I used to call a push pull aircraft that the FACs used to use. The Ford air controllers flew this airplane. anyway, two of us could go at a time, going back to this map recon thing, two of us would go at a time with this pilot to fly over into Cambodia, mm-hmm. again to VR our area, our respective areas. So myself and Captain Thread, I think it was Thread Gill, West Pointer guy, we kind of flipped a coin, so to speak, who would get in the front. One guy had to get in the back, and the other would get up in the right front seat.
Mm-hmm.
I won, got in the front seat, it's just a little old, it's just an old dirt strip there.
Mm-hmm.
So the pilot doesn't say a word to us. He has his helmet on. He's got his dark shield down. And so we're pointed west. We're pointed west as we go down this little old dirt strip. Mm-hmm. And just as we're lifting off, because I've got earmuffs on to be able to talk to the pilot, I hear the pilot says to me, "So help me, Lord." He says, "It's yours." Okay? Well, I knew what he meant because he let go of his steering wheel.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of modest, not exactly like the stick we had in the back of the L-19, but kind of a modified-looking little steering wheel. But anyway, so I grabbed the steering wheel, and I'm controlling the. He still has his feet on the pedals, but Richard, we're going straight due west, fixing across the Saison River, mm-hmm. and be in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm a guy that is very, very happy and comfortable on the ground,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily up here. Now, we're going into Cambodia. I mean, we're fixing to be there in just a minute,
mm-hmm.
and I start envisioning all this flak popping all around this little plane, so help me, Lord. Now, this is happening all very quickly, and I still don't get it why this pilot laid this flying thing on me, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm holding on for dear life,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time, all these emotions, so help me, Lord, is... Man, we're fixing to start getting ack everywhere, Dusty, right? Well, we did it. And as we and there we are crossing the river, so that now tells me we're in Cambodia,
mm-hmm.
over Cambodia ground. So finally, when this thing finally leveled out in just a short order, the pilot pulled up his face shield, and he just started laughing like nobody's business. And what it was, he was aglow, a ground liaison officer that had been assigned months ago back at the brigade.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew him. He knew me, but of course I didn't recognize him when I got on the plane. I'd been
right.
in the field now for a number of months and wasn't even thinking about that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this guy. He was just jacking with me. And it was, I thought it was a cute little story because I really thought we were going to be
mm-hmm.
getting shot at. I really did. I didn't know.
What'd you say to him?
Oh, it was just a classic guy-to-guy thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just a classic deal like that. Well, you know, you got me this time, da da da,
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just one of those little cutesies. But while we were doing that, of course, the troops were being moved overland from Camp Radcliffe out to Plaisirang,
right.
where we ultimately, got on our aircraft and flew into Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
We had no real dramatic firefights over there, but I'll tell you one cutie is I got a number of replacements, we received a number of replacements, you know, back at Camp Radcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I'm far removed from the average young rifleman, I really did try to meet them all. Sometimes it was difficult,
mm-hmm.
and you never got past that sometimes, but especially if we were in the field and a guy comes in on a resupply bird, obviously you had a better opportunity to speak with him one-on-one just a little bit. But anyway, we had these brand-new young guys, and so when we went into our LZs, we had some hot LZ going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we had incoming rounds, we had the M-60s on the carrying helicopters, and then we had gunships working the tree lines. So very, very noisy.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing really dramatic came of it. We didn't lose any aircraft. We didn't lose any people that I can remember. Anything. Just one of those deals.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're on the ground. We're in Cambodia. We're regrouping. I've got my lead platoon. I've got my CP together. I've got my drag platoon. I've got my flanks, all those stuff in place.
Mm-hmm.
And we're fixing to move out on a given azimuth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got this. I could hear it in his voice, Lieutenant Bruce LaValle. He lost the platoon sergeant later, but his lieutenant. Now he's using proper radio telephone procedures, But he basically said, that's just Alpha 6, Alpha 6, this is Charlie 6, over. Roger. He said, I've got this soldier back here who's a new soldier who's refusing to go with us. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a difference in a lieutenant and a captain. That's why we're called the old man, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're wise beyond our years. Well, this, I never missed a beat, okay? Because the lieutenant really, truly thought he had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, I gave an instantaneous response to his circumstance, doctor, and I said, so he said, so this soldier is refusing to go with us. And I said, Roger, leave him out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, it was just really that simple of a circumstance. He's going to go with us,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Where else is he going? Are we going to call a taxi in for him?
Right.
So the point is, it was very simplistic to me. I understand the young man was scary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was his first time in the field, all the shooting going on, both good guys and bad guys, noise, etc. But hey, you got to come along.
Right.
You really do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we marched out, and it wasn't a problem, but it was just one of those little cute little things in my mind that you remember that this lieutenant, who was a good lieutenant, really thought he had a problem.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about what you did in Cambodia, and how long were you in there?
Probably 2, maybe 3 weeks. I'm not fully sure.
Mm-hmm.
But we never made any major contact. The same old scenario of source doctor, we did a lot of walking,
mm-hmm.
or as we say, humping.
Mm-hmm.
One time I was making a speech to the Chamber of Commerce, I think it was in the city of Anchorage, and I was speaking to all these civilians at this luncheon, and I kept talking, humping,
mm-hmm.
and I was getting the oddest looks from these civilians till someone finally brought it up, and I had to explain what we were really doing.
Mm-hmm.
But we did a lot of that in Cambodia. I can see, in fact, I have the crossbow. I brought a crossbow out of there from a village that we were told that, you know, there were sympathizers
mm-hmm.
in there, and we went online, and I can remember that particular incident where we went online, you know, early in the morning
mm-hmm.
and moved through, and the village was empty. I mean, it was like a little town, so to speak, but everybody was gone, and we were, we were told to destroy, because it was primarily, or at least the intelligence would have us believe or tell us that there's no rhyme or reason why this village should be here, okay? It's got to be a bad guy village, or even if it isn't, it's in support of.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to destroy it, and there was, livestock about that we had, you know, anything that the enemy can use, we must destroy.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't, I'm jumping ahead, but I just thought about that. At one time, this is back in the other part, but...
Let me ask you a question.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Before we leave that, how did you actually destroy the village? How do you go about destroying a village?
Just burn it down.
Okay.
I mean, there's no real textbook to it. We obviously went through it looking for weapons and
mm-hmm.
anything that might... I don't know. I can't remember, you know, if we ever really found any cache of hardcore weapons.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember all that, but we did go through it, and... not like we pillaged and did all that. It was pretty empty out, but
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, I remember taking this crossbow, because if I didn't make it a point, if I didn't, someone would, because it was there.
Mm-hmm.
But I really was somewhat remorseful, because my mind was, first of all, this isn't a weapon in a sense that it's used against. Well, it isn't used against us,
mm-hmm.
and someone spent a lot of time constructing this thing, fabricating it. And we took it. I took it in that particular case. There were others, I'm sure, but that's the kind of little human thing that, this might be a bad guy village of sorts, but these are people just trying to get by too, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were you issued any special instructions when you went into Cambodia about how to react? You're in a quote unquote neutral country. And this is the official government, U.S. government position, and this is what you should or should not say if you're captured. This is what you should or should not talk about. Any special instructions?
I'm sure there were. but none that that come to me that were out of the ordinary or out of the norm.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty much business as usual for all intents and purposes. This would be my statement based on your question is, mm-hmm. if I hadn't been told that we were in Cambodia,
mm-hmm.
one, I don't know that I would know the difference, number one, terrain-wise in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, I'm there to kill the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I have a run-in with him, we fight. So I don't remember any dramatics, any dramatical rules changes or anything like that.
Okay. Did you ever run into any Khmer forces?
Oh, no, no.
Okay.
No.
Okay. So this was basically a 2 or 3 week search and destroy mission on foot?
Yes.
Okay. And you had air support, obviously, same kind of air support you would have over in South Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And artillery.
Okay.
I think we were probably on the outer ranges of the fan for an artillery, but I'm confident we had some artillery. I say that, but having said that, I'd like to think we were, but then I can't remember any artillery as such at Plaisir-Ring, so maybe we were a little higher and drier than normal.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly we had chopper support.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else that happened in Cambodia that you would like to talk about?
No, it really was, even though it was into Cambodia, but it wasn't much more than a standard excursion for us, if you will.
Okay.
I do remember Brigadier General Wheelock coming out and visiting with my unit in particular,
mm-hmm.
which worked to my gain, I guess. I'm sure he visited many units, but two things out of that. Remember, I lost my battalion commander later. I know I get ahead of myself. That loss was before, you know, after Cambodia. But it turned out that General Wheelock, who ultimately became two-star and commander of Fort Polk, I never knew him, met him back then. But he endorsed my OER. He couldn't rate it because the raider would have been the battalion commander,
mm-hmm.
but because the raider, my raider went away through death, they had to exercise an OER, an officer fishing report, and General Wheelock wrote a very strong report for me, you know,
mm-hmm.
one of, if not the finest company commander in the division kind of a thing, which mm-hmm. I guess helped me because I was promoted ultimately below the zone. But what happened when we came out of Cambodia, what worked against me there is, for whatever the reasons, he personally selected my company to go into some ambush sites north of Pleiku.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there was apparently a pretty good infiltration of sorts while we were in Cambodia coming into the Pleiku area. So when we were pulled out of Cambodia, and everybody got to go home or have a little stand down, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
We got resupplied. My company got resupplied with double rations and ammo, and we were inserted north of Pleiku, not to be resupplied for the week or so that we were there,
mm-hmm.
because we were going to ambush kind of sites.
Mm-hmm.
And but there again, so we did that. But there again, there were no significant battles. As such, and then ironically, this is another little story. Maybe we can stop at this point, perhaps,
okay.
or whatever. But another one of these stories that come out. But this is one that has. We may have mentioned it informally when we were visiting, but we were supposed to be pulled out by a given time of the day by some trucks.
Mm-hmm.
coming out of Camp Honore or Camp Holloway, which was some base there, support troops. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
they got stuck. They stuck up some trucks and whatever, and the point is we were late getting out of this area north of Pleiku.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to get back to Pleiku, and then the plan was we were supposed to drive from Pleiku over to Camp Radcliffe, which is the division base camp. Well, because of the delay with these stuck trucks and everything, we did get fed. We got fed the evening meal at some some base there in Pleiku, you know, like the helicopter facility or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But we still had, I still had the, you know, all our Deuce-Nahas with us, and my plan, we were to go into Camp Radcliffe. So we got my boys fed, and we got out on the outskirts of Pleiku out to the highway which runs through Mangyang Pass.
Mm-hmm.
Got out to a military police station, and they said you can't go, it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
There can be no more convoys. We don't have any military police escort to take you. Of course, I'm the lead truck right now, and I've got all, you know, any number of 20 guys hanging off the rails of this old deuce and a half behind me, and all the trucks behind that. And they're taking all this in. You know, they're just thinking, what's the old captain going to do here?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, what in the hell do I need a gun jeep for?
Mm-hmm.
Look behind me. And I probably said it. I know I was thinking it, and I'm sure at one point I probably said it. I said, look behind me. I've got 120 or 30 guys with X number of M60s and 100 M16s and X number of M79 grenade launch, you know, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm not, you know, whatever I said. I said, you know, there's no way. I have no place to go, number one. And I think we can handle anything that's out there on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but sir, you can't go. And I think there was an arm down across the road there. I'm just confident that there is. There was something. There had to be. And I basically just said, and I know my boys are listening, you know, and I says, Sergeant, raise the, you know, do whatever I had to have him do. I says, but we're going to Camp Radcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
And I just jumped back up on my truck to get in, and he said, but sir, he said something pretty dramatic. You just can't do this, or you're going to, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like my beret story of sorts, doctor, because they raised the arm, or I know I didn't bash anything down, but we just kind of pushed through their barrier, whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
and off we went. And so my boys cheered mightily, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all well and good if we don't get ambushed.
Right.
Because once again, I hung it out there for my boys,
mm-hmm.
that if anything had gone awry, and it didn't, anything had gone awry, because, you know, MPs hollering at me, oh, they're going to get you over there, you know, they're going to be waiting on you and all this, that, and the other.
Mm-hmm.
And we rode into Camp Radcliffe, and I may have got a dressing. I don't even remember a dressing down, though. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we probably caught some. I probably caught some trash at the MPs going in.
Mm-hmm.
But we went right on to, you know, to our battalion area.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't even consciously remember a dressing down, or not even a dressing down, but I mean, you know, the command, the battalion commander saying, naughty, naughty. I don't remember anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So no consequences suffered, other than the point is I got my troops. We've been out, you know, in Cambodia and then totally in the bush, in ambush sites for over a week, you know, up in Pleiku. And
mm-hmm.
I wanted my boys home, not home, but mm-hmm. where they could bathe
right.
and sleep in Iraq.
It seems that you had a good relationship with your men and your company.
I really did. I truly, truly did. Yeah.
Did you ever hear of any incidents or witness any incidents of fragging?
No. I must say to you that I was fearful for myself on an occasion that I'll share with you.
Okay.
I had there were two times in firefights, my first tour,
mm-hmm.
my second tour, that I twice found E6s hiding in a firefight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we always say, well, you have the legal right to shoot them and all that kind of stuff, and I'd like to think I wouldn't, but almost if I had it to do over when I think about it. In both cases, I literally crawled across these guys trying to maneuver people or do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And here we got those, as I mentioned earlier, those draftees, those U.S. guys with the U.S. Service number doing everything they can to return fire on the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And here's, so help me, I can't remember, I wouldn't know the first guy's name, my first tour, because I got him out of there in a hurry. That was my first day in the field, right,
mm-hmm.
with my platoon.
Right.
He's gone, but the other one was a sergeant first class. He was an E-7, that's right. Maldonado mm-hmm. was hiding the same in a like manner. Got him out of there. But what happened is I had, any time when I had my troops come in, there were two things that I always told them. And one of the things that I told them was, we have no room for prejudice out here in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? No room for that. There, if you've got that, you know, leave it. We don't have time for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a black E6 Mortarman.
Mm-hmm.
So he was an 11 Charlie, I guess, versus an 11B. Well, we didn't hump our mortars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You can't carry an 81-millimeter base plate out in the field in a tube, and you can't do that. And now, that one place where the battalion commander died, I had him out there then because we were had a stationary facility. And in the hills, I needed that indirect fire support.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, for the most part, the Mortarman got over, as we used to say. And so here I had an E6, and I say black to make a point.
Mm-hmm.
He was a get over. And all these three incidents, the two guys that hid and this guy here, were all, this is Jim Wheeler's term, I don't like the word lifer. So I use the term lifer for a careerist who just uses the system.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw an E6 and an E7 in the field hide, they're lifers to me. They're not careerists. That's just my Jim Wheeler.
Okay.
So here I had a guy acting like a careerist, but he was a lifer, in my opinion, who stayed in the rear and took no... He's an E6.
Mm-hmm.
Took no initiative to do anything. And I got these reports back from my company, from my first sergeant and from my XO, my lieutenant. And he took no initiative to do anything. And so... on a given, and this was, well, it's very end because I'm at the end of my tour. Just before my last major move in the field,
mm-hmm.
I had sent back an order for him to go out with a particular platoon
mm-hmm.
to hump the bush, to exercise his role as a non-commissioned officer, and to learn and benefit and gain from this for his own good, for his own development.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my last combat assault. We're on an operation. We're going into an old fire base place. It was terrible because
mm-hmm.
it had been booby trapped. Now we're booby traps.
Mm-hmm.
And all the sandbags all overrun with elephant grass and all that stuff. And we went in and everybody was getting stuck with these dadgum punji stakes, and I'm moving down, and I'm trying to do my work as a commander. I want my M60s on High Avenue, Vance, all these different things where I need to employ my weapons, and I'm going down this little trail, and the elephant grass is everywhere, and zap, boy, I got zapped in my left calf. I took a punji stake deep into my leg, and.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up getting dusted off, would you believe, with one of our resupply Chinooks.
Hmm.
And they dropped me in the middle of a field back in back at a forward support area, and I couldn't walk. And I just crawled off of the CH-47 by myself, and there I was. And I could see a couple of hundred meters over there, you know, the row of tents and things.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't do anything about it for the longest. I think they finally found me or saw me waving or something, come and pick me up. But what I'm getting, really, that's not the point of the story. But I was hospitalized, and I wound up over there with a number of my guys as we got opened up and all that stuff. But anyway, I got released, and I'm like 2 or 3 days to Deros. I'm going home.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I've returned to the battalion rear. And I'm on crutches. Oh, I came home on crutches. And I'm walking one day. I'm hobbling down the battalion area towards the mess hall. And here comes this sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know his name. Can't remember his name. But I'm hobbling along here, and we're coming, you know, one-on-one. And we come up to one another. And he starts giving me some shit.
Hmm. What did he say?
Words to the effect that I was a racist or prejudiced, whichever word it might use, because if he hadn't been black, he wouldn't have been sent to the field. that theme.
Okay.
Well, that runs red with me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of a theme, well, it happened real fast, and I had to lock his heels, as we say, you know what I mean? He was very emotional about it,
mm-hmm.
okay? But it wasn't about that. It was about him having to do something,
mm-hmm.
okay? Is what it boiled down to the fact that he was having a soldier for a change because he had been getting over, and I knew it, and he knew it. But he turned it around and threw it back to me that, and when he said the only reason that happened was he was black, I could have shot him to make a point. I wouldn't have shot. He incensed me to no end because that's the farthest thing from my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I'm getting to when you mentioned fragging is, so I had another night, probably two nights, I'm sure at least two nights. I was there about 3 days before I was to leave. So I had at least one more night, if not two, still there in the battalion area. And of course, I slept up on a little officer's thing, you know, still tents and stuff. But so help me, Lord, doctor, now he never threatened me, okay? Please understand that. In other words, I locked him up, locked his heels, and told him what the reality was,
mm-hmm.
not what he was trying to make. And that was a fact. And then I excused him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've heard stories of fragging. I never had anything close to me or anybody I knew. I never knew of any personally. I was never in the rear anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I never had any dealings whatsoever with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I said to myself, you know, what an irony. Because this guy was mad. He was mad. I mean, he was mad, okay? Mad and what he had built in his mind as aggravated as I got when he threw that in my face.
Mm-hmm.
So I feared. I was more fearful there the next two nights of sleeping there than I was ever any time in the field, because I really was fearful that, one, the irony of life, Murphy's Law, or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. the irony of life to have lived through two full tours,
mm-hmm.
still got wounded on my last combat assault,
mm-hmm.
and then to die with a fragging.
Mm-hmm.
Was just unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not rest well. I still don't, but I didn't rest very well those two nights, if they were two nights, whatever they were.
Right.
And what a way to have to end it because of that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
But you made it
through there.
Oh, absolutely. And there was, like I say, I don't even remember seeing him again. It wasn't like I was ever threatened or mm-hmm. anything else, but that was absolutely on my mind.
What kind of tension did you see between draftees and enlisted or regular military?
None.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't see any.
Okay.
I saw them all the same. I'm just saying, what I'm trying to say is I'm giving, you know, if you will, extra credit
mm-hmm.
to those guys who never asked to be here to begin with, but because they are here, they're doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. above and beyond, especially those guys that literally hit in battle. Not that every U.S. was perfect. I'm not saying that. We know that. But I'm saying that I was mightily impressed many, many times with my U.S. soldiers.
Okay.
Not to mention the RAs, of course, but especially those who were drafted.
Right.
And they rose to the occasion.
How much tension did you see between those who were out in the field, like yourself a lot, and then personnel who were in the rear most of the time? Was there any tension that you witnessed?
Amen. Big time. Now, there again, the good fortune, in my opinion, of the 4th Division soldier, as a rule, remember, we stayed in the field. We were just always in the field versus, say, the 1st Infantry, who never even humped with their rucks but had them flown in at night and worked in and around Saigon and populated places.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed in the field. And so, again, we did not have an awful lot of contact with the rear.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I've got another story that's pretty dang dramatic.
Okay.
To tell you how bad it could be.
Okay.
But our guys, there was something else I wanted to say, and I hope I'll think of it, but we stayed in the field. And the irony was, this is a perspective from a field troop,
mm-hmm.
we were just field troops. But the most dramatic photos that I've ever seen of Vietnam soldiers,
mm-hmm.
the guys with all the bandoliers and all this stuff, they're always the rear guys,
mm-hmm.
the wannabes. And that's, I don't mean that badly. I mean, they're the wannabes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just human nature, but this happened. this is a true story. All my story's true, but
right.
We were in a stand down, but this is, let me think now, let me get this right. I know what I'm saying is true, but I thought it was Campanari. I guess it was.
Okay.
It was Campanari when I moved up from Bambi to it, and before we moved, we were in, I say we, you know, me personally, but we're moving over to Camp Radcliffe, so
right.
We're in Division Rear.
Mm-hmm.
And another irony is, I know what I wanted to tell you, but the average life of a soldier in the 4th Division, but we rarely, as I've said before, if ever got to the rear. And the irony was so often, if a guy got to the rear because he had a bad tooth or he had to come in for something like that, he'd get to the PX, and it's either closed or they're sold everything. They, you know, it just, and the rear guys always got all the good stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this happened. I'm in my command in a little old barracks thing, and one of the nicest young men I ever knew was one of my radio operators. Nice, nice young man.
Mm-hmm.
Had gone off way across. Now this is 4th Division base camp, so it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
But he, like many others, had gone off to the PX. And he was coming back to our area, wandering in and out, you know, in a maze through, you know, barracks and this, that, and the other, or quasi-barracks.
Right.
Now, this is another time I'm saying black, and I'm really, I'm not apologizing for it because this is the way it happened, but they're not meant to be, in the purest sense, black stories.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the reality of this. I'm sitting in my CP, and this kid comes in, beat to hell and back.
Mm-hmm.
And he had wandered through, just, you know, meandered, you know, working his way back over wherever we were. And he had been jumped by about 6 black guys.
Okay.
American soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Rear area MFers, mm-hmm. as we call them.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did they take all the little things they would have bought, which couldn't amount to hardly anything,
mm-hmm.
but would be a luxury for him in the field, versus they who have refrigerators and things in the rear, they beat the crap out of him.
Hmm. This is one of your soldiers?
My radio operator.
Okay.
I went over to my rack. I buckled on my 45, put on my cap, and I, after I'd gotten all the word and where he, how he had traveled, and God is my witness, Richard,
mm-hmm.
I prayed that they would jump, because now it's pure dark.
Mm-hmm.
It was just dusky when he came in. I went in and around every place that he told me he had traveled through, and I prayed, I promise you to the Lord, I prayed that they would come out and jump me. Because
mm-hmm.
I'd have killed them.
But nothing happened.
But nothing happened.
Is it because they saw your captain's bars?
I don't know. I don't know. I'd like to think that I don't. I know I said I put on my cap, and I did, because I wouldn't cry without my cap. But I'd like to think that, I don't know, that I would have camouflaged or whatever it may have been. I wasn't trying to look like a captain.
Right.
In that regard, I know I put on a 45,
mm-hmm.
and I thirsted. I make no apologies. I thirsted for them mm-hmm. to jump me.
And
thank God they did it.
What would have happened?
I'd have killed them.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. Unequivocally.
Okay.
They messed with my troop. A fellow American just beat him mercilessly. I mean, not that he was going to die, but they just beat the hell out of him.
Mm-hmm.
And there sounds like a contradiction there when I say I'd kill him. But I'm telling you, at that time, and God knows better for me, he watches out after me. But I would not have hesitated. I locked and loaded, and I was ready. So help me.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, why don't we end on that story and end for the day?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.